but it has not fired this many people at once. No Tech for Apartheid, the group representing the workers, said it will continue organizing until Google cancels Project Nimbus. And in weather today in Washington, D.C., it is 68 degrees under fair skies. For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Good afternoon, listeners. I'm Paris Nruzzi, and this is Taking Action on WPFW 89.3 FM. We come to you every Tuesday at 1 o'clock, bringing the information and inspiration that you need so that you can take action to fight displacement in our city, save our schools and communities, stand up for justice, build our power, and hold government officials accountable. Taking Action is produced by the grassroots organization Empower DC, and we welcome your feedback and your show ideas. You can call Empower DC at 202-234-9119. I hope you all are doing well this beautiful spring day. We just had the celebration of Earth Day this week, and I told my daughter, every day is Earth Day, so I hope you agree with me. Every month is Black History Month and every day is Earth Day. That's how we live our lives, right? So I'm excited to be joined today by some very good friends who do amazing work lifting up the cause and the issue of environmental justice. Today we're joined by Dr. Adrian Hollis, who serves as the Vice President of Environmental Justice, Public Health, and Community Revitalization at the National Wildlife Federation. And I'm also joined by two fabulous community organizers from Empower DC, Sabrina Rhodes and Anthony David Jr. Thank you, all three of you, for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Great. Well, I'm super excited to have this conversation. Part of the reason why we're doing it today is because we have a big event coming up on Saturday, the first annual. We're planning to make this an annual thing, Environmental Justice Action Summit. And we want all of our listeners to know about it and hopefully to join us in person on Saturday, April 27th. We start at 10 a.m. We go all the way until 5 p.m. And we'll be talking more in the next few minutes about how to join, where we're going to be, and why you should come. But I want to get started with somebody who is inspiring me and supporting me in our EJ journey. And I'm so grateful for the opportunity to have gotten to know Adrian Hollis, who's just such a fabulous person all around. So Dr. Hollis, thank you again for joining us on Taking Action. And if you wouldn't mind, could you just share a little bit about yourself, maybe a little bit about your personal journey in the EJ movement?
And, sure. And thank you, Parisa. And it's Adrian, of course. And I'm very happy to be here. I appreciate the invitation. So I am originally from Alabama. From Mobile, Alabama. I've been very close to Africatown, where the last slave ship landed, and well, never landed, actually. It was deliberately sunk in the Mobile River. And the slaves that made it to land created Africatown. And we are located all in the shadow of polluting facilities. I am the daughter of a six-time cancer survivor. My mother is 88 right now. She does have diabetes and asthma and all the things that accompany people who are exposed to polluting facilities and to pollution, air pollution specifically. But she's 88, so we're very happy to still have her with us. When I grew up in Mobile, which I know most of y'all weren't born then, we were unofficially not allowed to go to Pensacola Beach. We went to, we called it a beach, but I don't think it was a beach. It was just an area of brown and black water across from the state docks, which we didn't know at that time. Well, we didn't know what it was anyway. A Superfund site, a hazardous waste site. So the water was always brown and black from oil and other contaminants, and there was always wood floating in it. But this is what we knew, right? And the soil, the sand, whatever you want to call it, was always dark brown, not white like you'd see a little further down. And I just remember this one episode of getting into the water in a white two-piece, because I was a little child, and I was in there for about 5 minutes, and it came out black, and it was never white again. So that was my first exposure to environmental justice, along with, you know, just the usual that people who live near facilities, paper mills, right? That smell, that's, you know, and when you ask about it, you're told to not complain because that's the way money smells, right? But that's also the way that, you know, pollution smells and health threats smell for our community. So that was the beginning of sort of my journey. I did kind of divert at various times, but when I ended up in my postdoc after I got my degree, and I was asked to compare cigarette smoking and how it targeted youth in the white community and the black community just by driving around in Boston. And what I noted was that for the black young folks, the advertising was like eye level. And it was always with some cool group of people hanging around as if to say, you can be cool if you smoke cigarettes, right? Which we know were deliberately addictive in the black and brown community, because of, not just because of the menthol, but the tobacco itself. And in the white communities, the advertisements were on buildings, were not in, you know, at eye level. And it was more like be the Marlboro man or something like that, you know, targeting adults and not really children and youth. So that was my heads up. And when I left, when I was actually working for the federal government at that time, the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry as a section chief, and I decided I needed to do something more with the community. And I left there and went to Florida A&M, actual university. And part of my agreement was that I could work in the community and take my students to the community and actually hands-on. And so that's kind of, you know, I'm jumping around, but that's kind of what I did and what I've been doing since then. I asked one of the community members, what do you need? Like, what do you most need? And they were like, at that time, people were having them, tricking them into signing their rights away and signing documents. And they still do that today. And they said, we need lawyers who look like us, lawyers who understand what we're going through. So I went to law school. I could have waited. I should have waited until they said, we'll pay for you, though. But I went on, and I didn't go back immediately into environmental justice work. But when I did, a lot of things had changed, but a lot of things remained the same, you know? And I guess we'll get more into that later. But the whole point was, we needed to be able to speak for ourselves as communities. And I remember being at the first National People of Color Summit when the 17 principles of environmental justice were created. And even now, people have conversations and they say, I like principles 3 and 4, but I don't like 5, 6, and 7. And then I have to explain that it's not a menu. You know, it's all or none. And if you choose none, then you're not doing authentic environmental justice with communities, right? And if so,
no, thank you so much. I really love learning a little bit about the things that have shaped your journey, and thank you for bringing up the principles and the convening. Could you talk a little bit more about that for the listeners who haven't heard about this momentous event that took place and the shaping of those 17 principles? Could you just bring us back there a little bit? And I have to brag because I was at the second I was not at the first. I was at the second. And let's see, what year was that? I don't remember. Was it like
93 or something? 91? I mean, 91 was the first one. So
no, I think it was, yeah, I think it was significantly
or late, even further
99 or 2000.
Okay.
I have to find it. But Damu Smith was organizing one of the big, large rallies. It was like an indoor rally. And I assisted him with that. And then I have to tell this story because then it started and he wasn't there. And I was like, it kind of forced me to get up on the stage and convene this thing because he wasn't there. And, you know, it was interesting because, of course, I, in retrospect, can see that that was a leadership development moment. But at the time, I was like, why isn't this man, he's leaving me out here? All these
because he knew that you were, it was time for you to step up and, you know.
Right.
Because you have the voice, you know. The first National People of Color Summit, I was there as an observer. I was actually still working for the government. So I walked around with my hand over my badge every day because I was like, I am at the wrong place, right? But it was national leaders. It was Bernice Miller Travis. It was so many different people who worked together to develop rules of engagement with communities. That if you follow this, you are doing the work with communities in partnership with them. If you don't, then you're not. And it was momentous. That was also, I think, the same time the President Clinton signed the executive order for environmental justice. I hope I'm not combining all these different events together, but it was a momentous occasion. I wasn't part of the group that wrote that. I was a part of the group that they kept busy doing other things, you know, talking and presenting and arguing and learning and all of those things. But it was, well, not the beginning of EJ. To me, it was very powerful because everybody got together. It didn't matter. It was all races, all people who suffered disproportionately from injustices, right? And I think it's a big thing that got us to where we are today. So.
Yeah. And, you know, one of our hopes for the summit that we're organizing on Saturday is to, again, foster that spirit of coming together, right? It's more local. It's not people from all over the country, but just across the city coming together and identifying other folks that are working on similar issues and how can we support each other and ultimately build power as a unified force to demand and make possible the changes that we know are needed. Talk a little bit about the current role that you're in and this moment that we find ourselves in where there is, at least in word and in money, and we'll see about the outcomes, lots of support coming from the federal government for EJ.
Yeah, this is a momentous time that we are in. And in my role as Vice President of Environmental Justice, and we just changed our name again because we do that, Environmental Justice, Public Health, Community Resilience and Revitalization, because that's what we're about, right? Mm-hmm. Is, you know, we worked with communities in partnership with communities to provide whatever is needed, to provide whatever services we can provide and to make sure they get the services they need and that they have a right to, that they are already have the power, you know, to receive and just have not been able to get that thing. To get that actions to happen. So one of the things, and this is how I really met you, although I have heard about you since before I moved here in 2016, moved to Maryland, I'm now in Florida, was about Empower DC. And we have this Thriving Communities Technical Assistance Grant with EPA and Department of Energy, right? The Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of Energy. Part of a larger Thriving Communities network of funding opportunities. But we received a $12 million grant. And Empower DC is, of course, one of our community hub partners. And it's all about making sure that, just in a nutshell, communities have the capacity to compete for federal dollars, because historically and traditionally, we've been left out of the process, just dismissed out of hand in most cases, because oh, I don't know, your grant might not look like as professional as one that was done by a grant writer. You know, so well, let's get the skills to do that. Or how do we get into the federal system? How do we apply for funding? Or, you know, we want to know more about energy justice or environmental justice, which we all know about. Or we want to build our capacity to work with other stakeholders at the state, local, and federal level, government agencies, or to address policy or create policy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just making sure that we have everything we need to be competitive, to be a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah. Well, it's exciting. And, you know, as you said, you we were able to secure the grant for this region, right? Region 3, and Empower DC is one of the partners. So we're just excited to be able to work alongside our allies from Delaware and Maryland and Virginia and other places and Pennsylvania. And of course, work next to you and Dr. Jacoby Wilson. So I want to bring Sabrina and Anthony into the conversation. They are doing the work on the ground as community organizers with Empower DC, but they both also are DC natives and come from communities that have probably experienced some EJ issues of their own. So would you mind, and I'll start with you, Anthony, just sharing a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in environmental justice?
Yes, my journey was an interesting one. I think, you know, with me in environmental justice, you know, I knew that there was something going on, but I just didn't yet have the words to put it together. You know, I was asking a lot of questions during, you know, over the pandemic, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement. And, you know, I've noticed, you know, within our Black and Brown communities, you know, it's a lot of things that were at play. You know, I was thinking to myself, you know, if I had to survive off of the land that's around me, you know, if the government shut down, you know, and I had to go somewhere to get food, to get, you know, access to natural resources, you know, why couldn't I do that, you know, within the community that I was growing up with? You know, that led me to ask a lot more questions to, you know, related to food accessibility, to related to, you know, healthcare and other things like that, to of people surviving off their natural lands. So, you know, I started to ask more questions, and then I started to realize, you know, wait, why isn't there a lot of Black people in the environmental spaces as well? You know, I come from a scientific background. You know, I started college as a forensic scientist, and, you know, something about that was kind of unpuzzling for me. You know, for the longest, you know, growing up in DC, you know, we always thought of, you know, hiking and other things like that as a white person thing. And I was really trying to figure out, you know, why is it, you know, why do we think like that? You know, why is it? But then I kind of realized, you know, a lot of this stuff is not accessible to Black and Brown people. You know, it a lot historically it has been dangerous for Black and Brown bodies to be in isolated areas. You know, historically, there's just been a lot of things that has prevented us to enjoy our natural environments and, you know, the lack of access of that. You know, so I made a decision to change my major, you know, towards the tail end of my sophomore year to become an environmental scientist. And, you know, then I started to learn now. You know, now I had all the questions I wanted to need an answer, but now I was actually learning. So, you know, I was in my college classes. You know, my professor is teaching me about environmental justice. At this point, I'm in Pennsylvania, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And, you know, I started to see, you know, more and more complex issues as it relates to this. You know, it's more than just the food access and the natural resources, but also it's how our environment is actually impacting us. You know, it's looking at the distribution of our heat and looking at the distribution of our pollutions and a lot of different things. So that kind of led me to wanting to do more. You know, I've always had an advocacy spirit. You know, I've always been kind of a community organizer. So I knew I wanted to do more. So that actually led me to becoming a environmental justice advisory board member with the state of Pennsylvania. You know, I was the youngest one on that board, you know, which was kind of interesting to me. You know, I had the background knowledge in terms of, you know, how this relates to people. I was just also building up my scientific techniques as well. So, you know, I started to play around with ArcGIS. I started to play around with other, you know, scientific techniques. And I really has, you know, expanded my knowledge, expanded my, you know, perception of how, you know, Black and Brown bodies are interacting with their environment, you know, when looking at hurricane patterns and looking at, you know, other, you know, resiliency models. You know, there's a lot of different things that are complex, but although it's, we're seeing the same trends across the nation, you know, you don't necessarily have to be a Black and Brown body to experience, you know, the the shortcomings of this. However, you know, we are the ones who contribute the least to climate change, and we are the ones who are actually, you know, impacting where our facilities and the amount of pollutants are going. However, we are getting the tail end of that, of the negative impact. So I definitely wanted to do more and definitely want to come back to my city to in order to do that. Because, you know, I kind of had to start at home before I do anything else anywhere else.
Yeah. And we're, you know, Anthony, I see a long future for you doing great work. You're relatively young man. I won't reveal your age, but you're just at the very starting phase. And so it's beautiful to see the initiative that you've taken to pursue, you know, this interest of yours. And I'm really excited to watch you flourish as an organizer and change maker. And Sabrina Rhodes has been working with us for almost 4 years now, I think, Sabrina, right? And has just been a huge asset. She's an incredible person, an incredible organizer, and I love her very much. So Sabrina, would you share just a little bit about yourself and sort of how you evolved into an EJ warrior?
Well, I'm from DC originally, and also was born and raised in a Deanwood community. My grandmother is still there. She came here in the 50s. She's 98 years old. So that's our home base, Deanwood. We've lived all over the city. But when I came here to Ivy City, that's how I got involved with Empower DC, through some watching Empower DC do what they do, and some protests that I joined, which was funny because I didn't know I was in a protest. And it was protesting the mayor, and also, you know, doing the block parties. And I was like, yeah, I need to get with them, because I never seen any organization in a district do what Empower DC is doing. Also, especially when I heard about the early head start. My twins are 23, and I had been trying to get them in her early head start, and Empower DC was that force to help open that list for early head start. So I've been living here in Ivy City for 6 years, and Parisa let me know that there was a chemical facility in the community, and it caught on fire in 2018. Zooks, who's our a scientist at Trinity College, she gave me the safety data sheet of the chemicals that's being used at the National Engineering Products facility. And that got my antennas up, because it's right here in our residential community. When it caught on fire, we wasn't told what was going on there, whether we needed to evacuate, whether the chemicals are going to be in our air. It was our research and our own advocacy, how we knew that this place is dangerous for the community of Ivy City. So from there, it was yelling and screaming about this place needs to be shut down. It should not be in a residential community. It has no air quality permit. It only has a certificate of occupancy. It smells horrible. It smells like burning tar 24 hours, 7 days a week, all through the year, no matter the season. And it's poisoning our community. And we all know that a lot of these factories and refineries and chemical facilities are in Black and brown communities all over the country. We're living with them right there in our backyard, and no one, but the community is yelling against it, whoever knows about it, but the cities, they're doing nothing. They're allowing this to happen, and it shouldn't be. So, you know, once I got into that fight, and I'm constantly like frowning my face, and everybody that know me know I keep my face frowned up, because this place should not be here. It should not be in a residential community. Half of Ivy City is business, is industrial. We have two parking lots full of the DPW fleet. We have New York Avenue. We have the Amtrak station parallel to New York Avenue. So our community, not only are we suffering from the urban heat island effect, we're suffering from the chemicals that's coming out of that facility, cancer-causing chemicals at that, that's being emitted from that facility, formaldehyde, acetonitrile, toluene, methylene chloride. And these chemicals, through research, I had to learn about myself. I couldn't pronounce them. Now I can call them out. And they're harmful. They're cancer-causing. So just with the research, doing the research on this little place that sits on the corner of our community in our residential neighborhood just got me angry and wanting to fight more against the injustices that we're suffering at the hands of places like the National Engineering Products and the city.
Thank you so much, Sabrina. And you've done a huge amount to bring this issue to light, which, you know, those of you who've been following this campaign to shut down NEP, it's evidently been there for 90 years, yet the city said they were not aware of it, that they had just totally allowed this business to operate with no control and no enforcement or accountability whatsoever. Of course, because it was in a working class Black community. And, you know, just to be clear, the residential Black community came first. It was allowed to be put there because of racism, systemic racism. And so we have a lot of work to do as a society to repair these harms, right? And unfortunately, and what we've been experiencing with Ivy City is that, like, lack of urgency. They don't really take it that seriously. Oh gosh, the agency director said at the oversight hearing, I love chemicals. That was his response. I love chemicals.
I wash my hands in benzene.
I'm just like, you know, really downplaying very serious and legitimate concerns of people that would never happen that way, as you know, in a wealthier community and a white community. And it also just showed us how far we have to go to make sure that the laws are just. Yeah, the laws are not strong enough to protect our communities. Mm-hmm. And so when they say, well, it doesn't exceed the limits, it doesn't exceed the standards. Well, the standards are not strong enough. Dr. Hollis, do you want to touch on that a little bit?
Yeah. You know, the standards, the recent ones, you know, they're great, but they're not enough. Right. And you know, this is just what I was sitting here just wanting to say, is that this is why your event on Saturday is so important. Just like Sabrina learned from that and became an activist or more of an activist, this is how the community finds out. Like when I went on your tour, I didn't know. Nobody knew. And this is what we're doing, right, is spreading the word. Even today, it's 2024. Why are we still doing this? You know what I mean? Why are we still doing this? And we need to be the ones to talk about policy and that the standards, as you say, are not right. Because the question becomes, would you live here?
Exactly.
People say it's fine. Would you drink this water? Do you really wash your hands in benzene? I think not, right? But, you know, are the conditions that you have us live in acceptable to you? Mm. Were you to live here? And those are the kinds of questions we need to act. And that's why we have things like the TICTAC, the Technical Assistance Center, so that we can inform policy and change policy and play a role in that, because we should be in everything that affects us, right? By us, for us, right? Mm-hmm. You just got me excited. I'm sorry.
No, angry. I'm glad. Could you share just a little bit more about how people can actually get assistance from the TICTAC? And then I'm going to ask Anthony to share more of the details for Saturday's event.
Yeah, I'll be quick. So we have a website, and all of our partners, as Parisa mentioned, at Empower DC, and we have partners in all over Region 3, Maryland, DC, Virginia, West Virginia. We're working on West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and I feel like I'm missing somebody. We work with some communities in Delaware also, but we don't have an official partner there. But you can go to our website on the National Wildlife Federation at www.nwf.org. And then it'll take, and then go to our work, Environmental Justice and the Region 3 Tic Tac. Or easier, you can call, if you're a community, 1-800-757-1405. That's for community members. It's a 1-800 number. If you want to help us by providing assistance free of charge, you can call 202-792-5350 to volunteer your time and your expertise.
And so there's an intake process right now. Do you want to speak to that just briefly? Like, what types of communities, you know, should be coming to the...
First of all, disadvantaged communities. Let's talk about that. With, you know, those with low budget who are really exposed to contaminants, not people who have budgets of over $1 million or $800,000, whatever, because you don't need our services. If you're not a disadvantaged community, you don't need to be a part of any of this. And I'm sure as a partner, you agree. This, what we're trying to do is change the way history has prevented us from being, from receiving what we need. So we need people to complete the intake. It tells us where you're from, what exactly it is you're looking for, what your situation is, a little bit about your organization, and about where you're located. If you are in Region 3, because that's, of course, our first priority. And if you're rural versus urban and all of that sort of information, right? Because we want to focus on us, on people who have been overlooked in the past. So if you're an EJ organization, a community organization, or an individual in Region 3 and you want technical assistance around environmental issues, reach out to us. You can do the intake online, or you can call the number and do it over the phone.
And you can also, we'll have all that information available at the summit on Saturday as well. So Anthony, if folks want to join us on Saturday, what should they know?
Yes. So first you can visit our Empower DC site. So that's empowerdc.org. And you can go to our events tab to register for their event. Like Parisa said earlier, the event will be on April 27th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Lunch will definitely be provided, so please register ahead of time. And, you know, this event is going to have a stack panelist. You know, we have lots and lots of great, you know, professionals within this movement. You know, our first panel is going to look at, you know, kind of the history of environmental justice, looking at the challenges, but also the success stories of how we can tackle this issue. You know, we will be hearing from community voices during our second panel, you know, community residents from, you know, Ivy City, Brentwood, Buzzard Points, but also, you know, community organizers who've been working in different, you know, sections of environmental justice, such as resiliency, you know, food insecurity, and much more. And then lastly, we will be looking at different ways where we can provide that technical assistance. So looking at, you know, regulations assistance, looking at different mapping tools and whatnot. So this is definitely an event that if you are interested in, if you want to learn more, you should definitely attend by visiting our site to register.
And this is taking place right next door to Martin Luther King Jr. Library. So it's a church there, 945 G Street, the First Congregational Church. And we do have some childcare available. So please let us know by registering. As Anthony said, there's a little, once you register, you'll get a little pre-survey, and that'll ask what your needs are in terms of childcare and other things. Sabrina, what are you most excited about for the summit? Anything you want to highlight for people?
I'm excited about everyone getting together and learning something new, learning with things that they didn't already know, and just fellowship and everybody getting together and learning from each other. That's my main thing. I just want to hear the panelists. Like Anthony said, we're going to have many voices on different levels, and all of us are going to be in the same room together. And that's the biggest thing that we can ask for. And again, like we're saying, people might not know what's going on in their communities, but after Saturday, you're going to know something. You're going to know something. You're going to do some research. You're going to find out what's really going on in my community.
Thanks, Sabrina. And our goal is to have this summit launch a series of monthly workshops. So we'll get more in depth into multiple topics. We're planning for the fourth Saturday of every month moving forward. So you'll get a calendar and be on our list to receive updates for that. So as we close out, I would love to just hear from each of you your closing thought. It could be anything, like why should people get involved, or what is, you know, one thing that you are working towards, that you, your vision, that you really want to get this issue addressed. Who would like to start? I can, don't want to put anybody on the spot, but Anthony?
I was going to say, I could go first. We could say the best for last. But I think for me, you know, the thing that I'm most excited about is really, you know, once you get it, you know, super deep into environmental justice, you start to realize that, you know, a lot of these issues are connected. You know, there isn't any type of intersections of environmental justice that really doesn't touch. You know, environmental justice is definitely a housing issue. You know, it's a health equity issue, you know, and I feel like that's something I am grateful for being a part of this movement, is to making sure that we are really hitting all sides of generally what social vulnerability is within our society.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Sabrina, what about you? Something that you want to?
Yeah, basically the same thing, putting the power in our hands, elevating everyone's voices and making sure that people know that they have the power to make the change that they want to see in their own communities.
I love that. And Adrian?
And that, you know, that excites me, what both Anthony and Sabrina have said, you know, that that's where we are now. And, the, you know, I'm just excited at the possibilities from just listening to you two. I'm like, wow, yeah, the three of you, you know, that's what I'm excited about. I'm excited about the big opportunity for EJ to have a bigger presence in this movement.
And I would say, like Anthony pointed out, such an intersectional movement, you know, so it's not leaving anything behind. It's economic justice, it's housing, it's land use, it's repair, reparation, it's all of those things. And, you know, statehood in D.C. is an environmental justice issue, too. So many things. And we will use this platform as much as possible to continue this conversation. So this definitely won't be the last time that we talk about it. But we hope to see many of you this Saturday again at the EJ Action Summit. And you can go to empowerdc.org to register. Thank you all so much. I appreciate
you. Thank you so much.
Hope to see everyone there Saturday.
So we're going to have, I'm going to say goodbye to my guests, and we're going to take a very brief music break, and then we are going to welcome our guests for the second segment. So if folks don't mind, give me one moment to figure out what happened to my song. I'm going to go ahead and let my second guest come in, because I lost my song. Okay, here we go. And in our second segment, we're speaking with a number of great leaders with a wonderful organization called the People for Fairness Coalition. And just a reminder to the listeners, you're listening to Taking Action on WPFW 89.3 FM. And People for Fairness Coalition is an organization that I've had the pleasure of working with and alongside for many years. Have definitely appreciated the numerous issues that the group has championed, some of which we'll get to talk about today. So first, let me welcome my guests. And if you wouldn't mind, if you each of you could introduce yourself briefly and share a little bit about your role or how you got involved with People for Fairness Coalition.
Hi, thanks for having us. I'm Rochelle Ellison. I'm the Assistant Director of People for Fairness Coalition. I got involved with People for Fairness Coalition because I've advocated with them in the past, attended the vigils. And one of the co-directors, Robert Warren, had called me and said, hey, come on and be a member of PFSC. And we like, you know, your support and doing some things. So that's how I got to PFSC myself. And I believe in our mission.
Thank you so much. Who would like to go next? Please. We're having, there you go.
Hello, my name is Nikhila Smith. I'm new to DC. I've been here for about a year, in 7 months, maybe 8 months, and I've been homeless the whole time. And I had went to something called, it was a visual that was going on at the time when I was living outside. And I was like curious about it. And basically that's how I started taking steps to finding out about this coalition that I heard about and trying to, you know, eventually I became a part of it, which started helping me do some things that I needed to do.
That's wonderful. Thank you. And next.
Yeah, my name is Andrew Anderson. I started with PFSC as a returning citizen, someone who spent multiple years in prison. And so they give me a platform to help advocate for those coming out of prison. And that's what I do right as of this moment. My work basically surrounds just helping people. It's very difficult trying to find housing for someone coming out of prison, let alone being unhoused at the moment. So my job basically is to help and assist in any way I can, direct experience and utilizing resources that's available to me to help someone transition from being on a park bench to actually finding housing.
That's wonderful that you're able to do that work now. Thank you so much for that. And our final guest, to introduce yourself briefly.
Yes, I'm Dan Kerr. I've been working with members of the People for Fairness Coalition since 2012 on a series of projects, including those looking at the history of the federal city shelter and the Community for Creative Nonviolence. We've also done projects looking at the working lives of people who are unhoused and projects looking at gentrification of downtown residential communities and the impact that has had on creative homelessness.
Great. Well, I'm glad you and others are documenting the important work of People for Fairness Coalition. And Rochelle, I think we initially decided to talk today because you guys have an event coming up and we want to make sure that the word gets out and encourage people to come out to the event. Can you tell us what you guys are planning?
Yes, People for Fairness Coalition is hosting a candidates forum on our 16-year anniversary. So we hope to get people out to talk about their issues with the candidates that are running for office. And we're doing at large Robert Wright. He's been confirmed. Rodney Reds Grant has been confirmed. From Ward 4, Janice Lewis George has been confirmed. And Paul Johnson has been confirmed. We invited Ward 2, and we don't have confirmation from, not Ward 2, I'm sorry, Ward Brooke Pinto. Well, we don't have confirmation from Brooke Pinto. However, we want people to come out and talk about their issues, and the issues that I'll be talking about and raising is the Universal Right to Housing campaign public policy. That's an initiative of People for Fairness. And this is a racial equity issue. You know, we must reverse the effects of the displacement and gentrification in the District of Columbia because there's 54,624 Washingtonians spend half their income on rent. 73% are low income, and they have to choose between healthy food, healthcare, or paying rent. And we believe that safe, affordable housing should be a human right, not a privilege. Some of my talking points are to make the Housing Production Trust Fund meet its target goal of having its funds going to families with the lowest incomes, dramatically increase funding and availability for vouchers and subsidies in the Emergency Rental Assistance Program and all human needs programs, developing a universal housing tax-based subsidy system that ensures vulnerable populations can achieve the stability to succeed. And in addition to supporting that, we also want to support a public, social, and cooperative ownership of housing as it pertains to our universal housing justice for all. So that will be one of my talking points. And Nikki and Andrew and Professor Kerr can speak more to their talking points.
Wonderful. I'd love to hear. Nikhila, do you want to go next? And or Andrew, I see you on, you're available.
Yeah, my whole idea of talking points. Basically, you know, again, we just recently had a very successful, say, the Supreme Court rally for unhoused neighbors. And I've been working with the National Law Center for the Homeless to promote the idea that, you know, that we don't need to, or we should not have a policy that disenfranchises homeless people, and using the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution as a result of this punishing people. Which is cruel and unusual. I think we all can agree to that. To punish people for just the mere fact of them being homeless, there's no fault of their own. And that includes people who are returning citizens coming home from prison. We don't need that kind of policy. We don't need that kind of solution. Here in this city in Washington, D.C., with the mayor, you're spending over $500 plus million to build an arena, a sports arena, when a good portion of that funding, that budget, could have gone to building new housing projects for our unhoused neighbors. We have Ward 2. We have a piece of property that belonged to the University of GW, George Washington, and it's sitting there. It's been sitting there, and it hasn't been activated. And reason being, because they hadn't figured out what to do with it. So we have been, like, too many people trying to figure out the solution to homeless in this city. And basically what happens is hurting our homeless population, including our people coming off from prison. So, you know, we have issues that are coming up right now. And so we need to be more proactive. And that's what we're doing right now. We're up against the barrier. And so we're trying our best to find workable solutions. And so going, we're gonna fall into some pitfalls. We're going to fall into some locked doors. But we're determined. We have numbers behind us. And we're going to succeed. And this is part of the process of being an advocate. No matter what happens, you're always prepared for the next step. So again, the successful event yesterday at the Supreme Court, where all the people who showed up. Again, we want the Supreme Court to rule in the favor of homeless people, you know, not criminalizing them, not making them, you know, something other than what they are. We want to help them move from point A to point Z, and that's being able to get housing with a key in your hand and walk in the door and live the rest of your life. You know, that's what we want. We don't want to criminalize them. But as a result, if the Supreme Court moves in that direction, we're going to have another obstacle to climb. So we're asking for people to stand behind us, get on board, and fight the good fight, because that's what we're doing right now.
Thank you. Great comments. And Nikhila, would you like to add some of the issues that you're most focused on and want to hear the candidates speak to?
So my issues connect with every issue that's going on here. It's a funding for all. So I'm trying to push the issue that returning citizens, when they're in prison, and I'm going to try to say this fast, when returning citizens hit the streets, and, you know, they're hitting the street homeless, and they're also, they don't have any, when they hit the streets, they become singles. Singles are people who don't have family, so we don't get cash assistance. So that doesn't make any sense to me. If one of the number one things we need to live is money, we're being neglected of it. We're being told that you only need food stamps, which that is not true. So I believe that we all should have money so we can live. So the point is to make us work again, too. We want to get, I don't want to be made to work. I want to work because I want to. But how can you get to work and take care of your necessities if you don't have the things that you need? So it's going to be a strong debate, and I'm willing to stick and stay for this one, because I really believe that we need money. And if we don't have the money, we cannot work, we cannot take care of ourselves, which makes us like panhandle. Panhandle, I believe, to me, these are my thoughts. I think the rate of panhandle will go down if people have more money in their pocket, because they're not panhandling for like $1,000 a month. They're trying to make enough to make it through that day. And they actually know how to budget their money too. And I am one of those, so I can speak. You know, so it's going to be a long ride, but I believe we're going to win. And speaking about that case yesterday at the Supreme Court, I believe it's very disgusting. Because most of the people who are residents right now, if they fall on hard times, they're going to be homeless too. So what are we going to do? Put half of the world in prison? That's the best we could come up with instead of trying to take care of what's going on.
Thank you so much. I agree with you. Criminalization of unhoused people is so disgusting. I'm glad that the rally was a great success. I heard, over 600 people at the Supreme Court yesterday. I'm praying for a positive outcome. And yes, hopefully this evil position of criminalizing people for being unhoused cannot spread any further throughout this country and is really shut down. Professor Kerr, would you like to share, what are some of the top issues that you're following?
Yeah, I just want to say, just following up on Nikhila's comments, that you know, the issues that create homelessness are not homeless issues. These are, for the most part, are not. These are issues that impact a large segment of the population of Washington, D.C. and beyond. These are the same issues faced by people struggling to address the cost of housing, making do with low wages, don't have enough to afford the basic necessities. These are the same people the people who are dealing with the impact of the criminal justice system on their everyday lives, their communities, their families, et cetera. So I think sometimes, you know, we have a fairly a better understanding of the role of the criminal justice system today, but I think we still have to work on understanding of the role of the homeless social service system. We frequently think of it as a kind of a humanitarian solution to address the needs of those who are unhoused. But I think if we're truly wanting to understand this rise of the homeless shelter system, we're better off looking at it in terms of its relationship to the prison system and the criminal justice system. And I think we can look at it historically and see that the rise of the homeless shelter system and the rise of the prison system both rose together in direct correlation to the rise of economic inequality in this country. Homelessness does not, homelessness exists because business as usual benefits from the processes that leave so many people unhoused. The shelters, the logic of the shelter system and the homeless social service system is to keep people out of sight, out of mind, right? So that that system can perpetuate itself. Obviously, there are many different factors, and these are all important to understand and look into. But I do want to say elections are one place where we're able to kind of intervene and challenge some of those processes that create these economic inequalities. I do think that in order to actually create significant change, we need to support grassroots social and political movements. We see that over and over historically. That's how change happens. So what I would ask the candidates, in addition to these very pertinent questions that each of my the cohort on this call are talking about, is what are they going to do to support and strengthen grassroots movements to address economic inequality?
That's a good question. I haven't heard any candidate really articulate how they would do that. So I appreciate that very much. I just want to thank you all before we recap the details of the event, and because we're short on time, I just want to just applaud you. I have been a longtime fan of People for Fairness Coalition, led by people who have lived experience with the issues that you're addressing. You have been successful. I have seen the impact that your organization has had. And I loved the positive energy that each of you spoke to in terms of knowing that you can and will continue to make change, because that is the spirit that we need to keep moving right in this direction. So, and one of those successes, I know you were instrumental in the public restroom campaign, and I understand just this week there was a sighting of a new public restroom being built and constructed in the city. So, you know, you're making real change, and I really appreciate it. Rochelle, do you want to repeat the details of this event? Because I am encouraging all of our listeners to come out and hear from the candidates. Go ahead, Rochelle.
Absolutely. It's our 16-year anniversary, and we're hosting a candidates forum of the at-large council seats, Ward 2 and Ward 4, and ANC's Ward 2. It's at 1316 G Street Northwest at Church of the Epiphany from 2 to 7. And there will be three different time slots. Please come out, get your issues addressed. Ask each council member what they're willing to do about your issues, and get registered to vote if you're not registered. We'll be there registering people to vote. Mm. Please come out and talk about your issues and see what candidate is going to be best fit for that seat.
That's great. And again, I want to encourage you guys to come back on the show anytime, you know, to update us on your progress on the work that you're doing and keep people informed. So for now, again, listeners, Wednesday, May 8th, you want to come out to this candidates forum, and you can go to the website pffcdc.org to stay up on all of those details. Thank you all so much for joining me today. I look forward to talking to you.
Thank you for having us.
And listeners, thanks for tuning in to Taking Action. Stay tuned for COVID, Race, and Democracy. But first, the news.
From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Tuesday, April 23rd. Here are some headlines. The U.S. Supreme Court is due to hear arguments today in a case brought by coffee giant Starbucks against the U.S. federal agency tasked with managing labor disputes. The National Labor Relations Board had asked a lower court almost 2 years ago to reinstate a group of Starbucks workers fired by the company for allegedly violating policy. The NLRB considered the firings to be illegal interference, and the lower court agreed, issuing a preliminary injunction ordering the workers be reinstated. Starbucks challenged the order, saying different courts across the country employ differing standards when deciding whether to issue a preliminary injunction following an NLRB request. Starbucks is asking the Supreme Court to mandate the stricter of two sets of criteria for issuing preliminary orders. The NLRB says the stricter criteria is unnecessary. In more Supreme Court news, the justices took on the issue of homelessness yesterday as the court heard arguments on whether a ban on sleeping in public is cruel and unusual punishment. The case centers on a small town in Oregon, but could determine if cities of any size can cite and arrest people for sleeping outside in public when adequate shelter is unavailable. The court's conservative majority appeared sympathetic to the argument that questions around homelessness should be left to local governments. But the three liberal justices were more concerned with how homeless people are treated, noting sleeping is a basic human need. The court's decision is expected in early summer. In a Manhattan courtroom today, Donald Trump's criminal hush money case resumed today with David Pecker, Donald Trump's longtime ally and former publisher of the National Enquirer, returning to the witness stand. A focus of the questioning is the so-called catch-and-kill operations used by the National Enquirer to bury claims from women who say they had affairs with Trump. This follows a hearing this morning to determine if the former president should be held in contempt for allegedly violating his gag order 10 times in online posts. If that happens, Judge Mershon could technically impose punishments ranging from a small fine up to 30 days in county jail. In other news, civil defense workers in Gaza have now recovered at least 310 bodies buried in a mass grave at the Nasser Medical Complex in southern Gaza. Earlier today, UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk said he was horrified by the mass grave, which was found 2 weeks after Israeli forces ended its siege on the hospital. Some of the bodies found had their hands tied behind their backs, which indicates serious violations of international human rights law. Earlier this month, bodies were also reported at the Al-Shifa Hospital, Gaza's largest medical facility. The Human Rights Office is demanding independent, effective, and transparent investigations into the deaths at both facilities. And Google fired about 20 more workers it said participated in protests denouncing the company's cloud computing deal with the Israeli government. The primary reason for the protest was a project called Nimbus. This brings the total number of workers fired in the past week over the issue to more than 50. Google has fired workers in the past who publicly criticized the company, but it has not fired this many people at once. No Tech for Apartheid, the group representing the workers, said it will continue organizing until Google cancels Project Nimbus. And in weather today in Washington, D.C., it is 68 degrees,